Hi, I'm Dave Barnes.
And I'm John McLaughlin.
And welcome to Dadville.
Dadville is a podcast where we talk about life, love, and the pursuit of awesome dadding.
It's funny thoughts and deep talks.
So please, enjoy your time here in Dadville and enjoy this episode with...
Esty Smith.
Well, good day to you. It's Joel with the King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
What's the initial thing with authors? Why is that a thing? I think it's cool. I like it.
It's so dumb. So I was working at a cafe and I'd been laid off, and I was in a really low point in my life. I was making like $12 an hour, two young kids, and it's a really miserable part. And I was writing books, or I was starting to write, and I was getting published in this thing. And I was like, what am I supposed to, what should I do? Cause Sam Smith is, there's a bunch of other authors. And that was before the musician Sam Smith came around. But there was a real famous sports writer named Sam Smith. And it was like, so if you Googled it or searched or whatever, it was just like a nightmare. So I was like, I got to differentiate, but I don't know what to do. And my friend was like, we should be S.D. Smith. Like, you know, you love P.G. Woodhouse and G.K. Chesterton and all these guys. And I was like, well, I'll never do that. That's the dumbest. That is so pretentious. I would never do that. But anyway, I did it anyway. So.
And then here we are.
And it worked.
I decided to do it as an homage. It's an homage to my favorite authors instead of a pretentious little jerk who wants attention.
I think that as far as if that works for me, they're always synonymous. Sadly,
sure.
For me.
Yeah.
There, you can't separate the two. So, Sam, we are really, really, really excited to have you. This is kind of the first time that we've done this where we've had an author who writes books like you. Like we've had, you know, like I guess, John, have we had fiction writers on? I actually don't know that we have. Have we?
I thought you were going to say the first time I've had an author on that we have not heard of.
That we're not sure is an author, and that's fine, and we love that.
That we've discovered, guys.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that we've.
I don't know. Now I'm nervous because I'm like, I feel like we did interview someone who hadn't published a novel, but they had like written a bunch of books and they're working on a novel. I can't remember that.
Well, I think you. We're gonna call you the first for this, which I'm really. Yeah, that's right. It was AI. I'm really excited about this. I'm stoked to have you on, and there's a barrage of questions. So I want to get into this. And so what we do here on Dadville is we start with what we call the brag sheet, which is like, this is your life. Oh yeah. Okay.
Dadville alum.
Okay. Okay. Hasn't written fiction. I guess is every song fiction? I digress. Okay. So Sam, here we go. Wrote the Green Ember series, which is a million selling series, which is bananas. Green Ember made it to number one on the Audible chart for best selling audiobooks.
Which is crazy. That number is, one on again, Audible. That's insane.
So okay, is this the greatest title of a book ever? Mooses with Bazookas and Other Stories Children Should Never Read. Co-authored a novel with his son, which I'm so excited to talk to you about. Jack Zulu and the Waylander's Key. Founder of Story Warm, which is also really cool. Authored a course on writing called The Green Writer. Sadly, is a Liverpool fan. We're going to keep going through that. Fun facts, which I love this, grew up in South Africa. You and Dave Matthews, I was going to say, have a lot of things
pretty much
in common.
The same life.
Really similar. And turned 13. This is crazy. The day that Nelson Mandela was released from prison. That is so cool. So thrilled to have you on. Junior, this is, I'm really stoked about talking to you about this.
You keep talking yourself into it. I think the more times you say it, the more you're like, it's going to happen.
Yeah, it will. No, it's a manifestation thing. So first I want to, like, I mean, I know you get asked this a million times. Why Liverpool? No. What made you want to be an author? Like, how did that begin? It was just cafe days? You were dreaming about it? Or, you know, when did sort of that whole thing start?
Yeah, it was super organic. Really, you know, like a lot of people, it's the same story for a lot of people who write children's books, but it was, I was a dad. And so I told my kids stories. I was always that kind of a person. My oldest brother told me stories when I was little. I grew up in a holler in West Virginia. If you don't, I don't know if you heard of a holler. I don't know how cityfied you guys are, but you know, back in the woods, my dad said we lived so far back in the woods that no one lived behind us. When I was little, I thought that was true, which is,
that is so good.
A fantasy element comes in. Because I would just, like, imagine that, like, really? Like, if you just kept going back and back. And
nobody's back there.
But yeah, so I grew up with hearing stories and stories about animals, like, because that's pretty natural, you know, when you're in that kind of environment, a rural environment. I live in rural West Virginia, which is to say, I live in West Virginia.
Right.
So I grew up with stories about the pony and stories about dogs and stuff. So I would tell my baby sister those stories, and then I told my kids stories. It was just kind of a natural thing.
So when you say that your older brother would tell you stories, like what's the setting? Like you guys are like in laying in your bunk beds at night and like he would tell a story?
Yeah. Did you go straight to Little House on the Prairie? Is that what you were thinking?
A little bit.
You're laying in the barn on your hay beds.
Yeah.
And
Paul just,
I'm imagining there's livestock around.
Yeah. A little bit. So I literally did grow up. There was a trailer, which we moved out of a trailer into a basement of a log cabin that my dad was building in a hall in Wayne County, West Virginia. And he never finished the cabin. We went to the mission field. That was his dream, was to sort of build this log cabin out in the woods. And it never got finished. So I grew up in sort of a bit of a dank, dark basement that we were trying for years to get out of, but we never got out of it, except we did finally and went to Africa. But that's the setting for where my brother, and it was bunk beds. There were three of us brothers at that time, became four, really, really small little room. He had a bed, and then we had a bunk bed, and he would tell me stories. We're on like kind of a walk on the gravel road up the holler, stories about Sparky the horse, or Bojo the dog. And yeah, it was a great time.
Bojo, what a great dog name.
He was a border collie, and he didn't really belong to us. I think he belonged to a neighbor, Jack Smith, this old man who had cows and everything. And but he just, yeah, he was super loyal. He was a great dog. So I would tell stories to my baby sister the same thing. I would kind of just rehash those stories, and became very inventive. And actually, honestly, the living back in the woods. And we went to town to like go to school and stuff. That was an incredible like training ground for my vocation. I wasn't a reader at the time. I didn't really grow up like a lot of authors grew up, like going to the library all the time and reading nonstop. I liked like Star Wars and Indiana Jones and Star Trek and the Dukes of Hazzard and the Lone Ranger and sports. Like I loved football and basketball and soccer and everything. I love sports. So I was like more of a typical sort of a guy, you know. I wasn't really bookish until I was in my teens. But I played all the time, and I played in the woods with my brothers. We played army, played Star Trek. And if they weren't there, I would play anyway. And I would invent whatever. And we didn't have a lot of money. So my dad would like saw out, you know, from like the materials he was making the cabin with, he would like saw out like a gun, you know, or like a laser gun or something. And so we didn't buy all the stuff, like all the Star Wars stuff that we wanted, but he would make stuff. And then I would make like fleets of airplanes out of like bark, or battleships out of like bark. And I would make paper airplanes, and I would design them, and I would have a story for each one. And I would invent games and stuff. So I was always doing that kind of stuff, and boredom in the woods and a little bit of poverty is like are really great ingredients for being creative. So I feel like I was world building. I wasn't a writer,
right?
I wasn't a reader, but I was already a world builder.
Did you grow up feeling like, oh, I'm good at this, or did you grow up just thinking like, well, everybody's good at this? This is like people come up with stories. This is just what you do.
I didn't think about it at all, really. I don't think I never. It's only really like sort of looking back that I realized how much play was and boredom and all that was a part of sort of creating the capacities that I have now.
Yeah.
But at the time I would have thought of myself as like an athlete, like a shy kid who played sports and was like pretty good at sports. And I never would have thought of anything that was like intellectual or like bookish. I would have thought, no, that's not me. I'm not that at all. But so no, I didn't think about that at all as a kid.
And then you didn't start writing until after y'all had started a family. Is that true?
Well, a little bit. So in school, again, I didn't really notice it, but I would sort of write like little stories. So at one point, I think maybe it was in first grade. And again, I wasn't a reader. So I had a teacher that read Little Women to us and The Boxcar Children. But Little Women really stuck out to me because the character of Jo March is a writer. And I remember thinking, like, for some reason, you know, like you grow up pretty rural and you're far away from things. So you think, I thought of like a writer as like an astronaut or an NBA player maybe I thought of them as like vaguely like British or far away.
Right.
And so for some reason, the fact that Louisa May Alcott, you know, this Jo character, the teacher said something about it being based on her life. And I was like, oh, so she's like an American. And for some reason and she was like not rich and she had a bunch of siblings, which I had. And I just kind of it got like the distance went away a little bit. And I thought, oh, you can be a person can be a writer. And then I thought, well, like, that's the coolest thing. Like, why would you do anything else? Mm-hmm. So I didn't really think of it like necessarily vocationally or big terms, but at that time I thought, I'll write a little story. And so I wrote like a little dog story so I started doing that kind of a thing. And if we had an assignment in school, I was always kind of good at that. So I always thought of myself as, oh, I'm kind of good at that. But that didn't translate into like, I would like to be a novelist. I didn't really even think I knew about that. I still thought I'll play for West Virginia. And then I'll go to play for the Knicks and that'll be my life. You know, so I wasn't too, but it did the walls of like impossibility started to break down a little bit.
That's so, isn't it funny? I feel like so many of us in the creative vocational space, that is such a consistent story. It's like, you don't know it's a thing, whatever that thing is you do and you love to do until somebody, the world, life, classroom, TV, something brings it to the forefront where it's like, oh no, that's something people do. And you're like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Like people do that? Like people, I would know that. Yeah, you know, so-and-so.
Yeah.
You met that one time or whatever, your uncle, whatever it is. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, and it, you know, everything kind of goes technicolor.
Yeah.
And then life has this option for something that you just, especially when you have a gifting for it, like you're saying, Sam, like where you already feel a little bit of a proclivity for it.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah. And it's so slow, like clicking into place. Like there's like little parts of it, but I'm totally, you guys have probably experienced that where you've talked to somebody or, you know, like somebody in your family has been like, oh yeah. Like my kids have a completely different approach to the arts than I do.
Yeah.
My kids are like, oh yeah, it's normal to be an entrepreneur. It's normal to be, I'd never met somebody. Like I'm somebody that ran a business. I was like, nobody in my family did that.
Yeah.
Nobody went to college. Nobody. So there was it was just out there. It was weird. I knew like my papa wrote poetry and stuff. That was, so it wasn't weird, but it was just like to know somebody that ran a business, knew anything about money. It was just totally, but my kids are like, no, it's normal for a family to have a little, you know, a little business. That's just like a normal.
Well, we laugh all the time. John is a prodigiously good piano player, genuinely. And my kids are so used to seeing him play. And I'm like, this is like such a gift. And at the same time, you're kind of screwed because you think like, if you can probably, let's just walk a couple blocks and see if somebody up there plays piano. And I'm like, oh, no, that's not how this works. So one of the things, I have a couple of questions about exactly this. This is a job because I just don't, again, I've not sat and talked to someone who does exactly what you do really before. One of the things I'm curious about and inquiring minds want to know is being an author, anything like being a songwriter, in that when you're working on a book, on a story, right? Do you have those moments where you're mowing, you know, you're on a run, you're at Target,
you're about to
whatever.
Sink a three-pointer at the Y.
Yeah, you're just about to crank that three. And you go, oh my gosh, that's how that chapter ends, book ends. That's how the book begins, you know, and then you kind of grab your phone, or is that like a thing too? Or are you more like, no, like when I have, you know, where I write and it's when I go sit, that's kind of when I open the creative floodgates and it happens then.
No, I had the same like experience. I was like a failed singer songwriter. That's that's kind of part of my story was, and we could go into that, but there's a cliche, like how many hours a day do you work on your writing? And of course the cliche answer is all of them. Exactly what you're saying is, it's always alive. So I think it's funny, because I don't know if you guys experience this, but it's sometimes it's hard because people don't see like what the work you're doing all the time, but you're kind of, for me, I've always been like the kid that's like lays awake at night and I'm the 47-year-old man who lays awake at night and just the brain will not stop.
It's just going.
And it doesn't mean I'm like super productive or anything. It's often counterproductive.
Yeah, exactly. But
it's going nonstop unless I can like derail it with like an audiobook or something. But so I have to. Yeah, so it's always going, and I have the exact same experience.
Do you voice, let's say, again, for the sake of example, you're mowing the yard, and you're mowing and you're thinking. You're like, okay, and then it's like, ding. Is your move as an author, do you grab and voice memo? Do you type? Like, what is the way that you actually
get Dave that and thought I's, down? Dave and my phones are both filled with like hundreds and hundreds of little snippets of ideas.
I do that some. I'm the dumbest. This is the stupidest way. And I've not corrected it. But I send myself emails.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the subject line of my email will be like that, like 50 words of, and it's just got detail.
just the subject line. You don't even get to the body.
Yeah, because I'm afraid I won't or something. So I just like, and it's enough to get the thing down. But I'll do that like in the car or whatever. I'll usually pull over or sometimes I. And it's like all capital letters, and it looks like a Donald Trump tweet or something. It's so it's crazy, and it's like 90% misspelled, and it's terrible. So sometimes I'm looking at these, I'm like, what was I trying to say? Or I'll just say to my wife, like, email me the words gray stone thunder sword, you know, species X or some stupid. That sounds like something I actually don't write.
But actually, I'm wildly interested in wherever that was going
to
go.
If you're not going to use that, I actually would love to run with that.
I was
going to
say, yeah. Either that's already an AC/DC song or we're going to write it. So,
I feel the same way about capturing, like, especially as I get older, I've gone through the whole period where I thought, well, I remember things. And then positive I don't, which is such a much a better like humble orientation toward reality. And I just send myself emails, so many emails, and then I try to like get rid of those emails when I get to my computer.
And then I'll expand it
or whatever, make a little note. But yeah, it's been the same way. I have to capture stuff because it's
we laugh about this all the time, but our version of that is like the all caps misspelled is when we're on runs and you have a song idea and you try to sing it while you're running into a voice note.
Yeah,
and it just sounds like you're either on the losing side of a tickle fight, or like, you know, you've been dropped into a war zone, and it's just and then you're listening back to it, and you're like, wait, and you know,
I mean, I think it's actually been productive once ever for me.
I've done it.
You just went straight on the album, just like that.
That's my gosh.
That is the single.
Just sent it and it got mixed as that.
So we actually, Dave and I just did a couple episodes where we talked about work specifically. And I've said this many times on this podcast before. I had a hard time for me growing up. My dad was a super hard worker and had more of a traditional job. Was like, you know, left, worked, came home from the end of a day's work. And my mom as well. And so when I become an adult, I'm the singer-songwriter. Obviously, my day looks very different than my parents. And when we had kids, it didn't really, you know, come into my mind until we had kids. And I started to like think of the world that they're growing up in, the house that they're growing up in, and what they're seeing dad, quote-unquote, work. It was a real... It was a hard thing for me. I've been like processing it through the years. I've been a dad for 11 years now, right? But it was a thing for me for a while. Like I felt lazy. I felt like I was not really working because my days did not look like my dad's did specifically or my mom's. As you're describing sort of how you work and all that kind of stuff, like did you have any of that? Or what did you grow up seeing your parents do occupationally?
I have the exact same experience. I've been a parent for 21 years almost, and I had a regular job and transitioned to this. And even my regular job was had a little bit unusual hours, so I almost felt a little bit of that before. But yeah, I feel that because so much of it is mental, and so I feel that same, like I've got to prove to somebody. But I had the exact same thought even a lot recently, like, oh man, is it good that my kids are experiencing me? Like I just went through a real like, I don't know if you have this at the end of an album or getting prepping for an album or something, but like finishing a manuscript. And so like, you know, I'm on the downhill sort of plunge. And so I'm like, it's like 12 hour days and just trying to like stay in the world and like taking breaks, but I'm kind of like semi-human and mm-hmm. I'm not really, and I'll just keep going and I'll like sleep late. And that's sort of natural for me. And I'm like, is it killing my kids that I'm, you know, waking up at 11 a.m. or something and writing all day, you know, it had the exact same feeling. And it's funny. I'm very conscious even lately, like, I don't know, you sort of tell yourself, we're all storytellers all the time. And we're thinking about our life as a story. And that's kind of a big deal. You know, people are tuned into that. But it's so funny. I was on a walk with my daughter yesterday, my 11-year-old, my baby. I have four kids, two girls, 20 and 11, and two boys, 18 and 14. And I was with my baby girl, and she, and I think I was maybe in a particular sort of one of those like little bit natural, maybe natural sort of artist kind of funks, like telling myself a bunch of lies and mm-hmm. reinforcing that kind of stuff mm-hmm. and thinking like, and I had the exact same thought, like, what are my kids, like, what is my kids' experience of me? And it was so cool because that day, I had two gifts from her, and she, one of them was we were on a walk around sort of our little rural neighborhood, and she, I didn't even see it, but I looked down and I saw that she had like a package of like, I don't know, it was like a candy bar wrapper or something in her hand, and she'd like picked it up, and then she like bent down and picked up another one, you know, that was just like on the road somewhere, and I was like, oh, you know, good job, and she said, oh, I'm just like my dad. You know, like I was like, oh, she's like her story about me is like, that's in her mind is like, when we go walking around, like you pick up trash from places. And mm-hmm. It's a little thing, but to me it was a big deal. It was like, oh, the things I'm telling myself that the story that they're going to say that they feel is maybe not exactly lined up. Maybe it's not a tragedy, this dramatic tragedy.
Right. Right.
You know, and she even said later the same day, she said, oh yeah, we were going to play a game of some kind, I think checkers or something. She said, oh, she said, you know, I want to let somebody else pick. She's like, cause you always let other people pick. Like you, I want to be like you, kind of like you always let other people pick the game that you, even if you don't want to play it, like you play it. And I was like, that's definitely not the story I would have told right. about myself. And these are two little tiny things, but they meant so much to me because what I feel, it gave me a little bit of relief. Like, oh, maybe I'm telling myself this sort of tragedy about my poor kids going through this hellish, right. this hellscape of a life with this artistic dad who's a goofball and doesn't, you know, doesn't know his head from a hole in the ground or whatever. And I don't think I got that one quite right, but.
No, you nailed that. That's it.
Yeah, okay, good. But maybe it's not. Maybe it's not a tragedy. Yeah. Maybe it's a comedy with a wedding at the end. I don't know.
I mean, it's funny. If I got those two comments from my girls, that I would be on cloud nine. That would make my day. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think too, like that's I love that phrase so much. Like, how do my kids experience me? Like, that's such a fascinating, mildly terrifying thought. But I love you thinking about that. So. I have more questions, so buckle up.
I'd really like to wrap it up, but okay.
This is, guys, I got to mow the yard, if you don't mind.
I got to email myself a novel chapter.
You're just like,
don't do.
So here's one of the things that I think is so fascinating about what you do. When you are building these stories, like you said, you're building these worlds, right? These characters that occupy not just one book, but carry through a series of books, you know, so that the people who read them really get to know them and have these great affinities for them as the heroes and whatever. I just feel like it would be so much pressure, especially, you know, when you're having success like you do, where you, I mean, it's, I love the pictures on your Instagram of all these people that are at these events to see you. And it's got to be so affirming when you see that, to go like, man, all these people enjoying what I'm doing. But I just sit there and I go, I just think it would feel so heavy when you realize that you can make these huge decisions with a character that means so much to people on a whim. I mean, you would never do that. But I think about that so much. I'm like, that has got to be a really weird thing, unless you're just like, oh, no, it's like you guys writing a song, you know, I'm going to write more and this is what I've chosen for this character. But I just think it's so fascinating to think that all those people that are reading, all those people that come to these events, they're looking at you going like, okay, you got one more book in this series. Like, what are you going to do? I'm like, oh my God, that would feel, you know, like when I watch a series I really love and I'm really into a character, I'm reading a book series, whatever, you know, I'm like, what are they going to do? Like, what are they going to, I mean.
And you decide all of it.
And you decide all of it. Like, that's crazy.
Yeah. I was talking to my dad. My dad's a combat veteran from Vietnam. And he went to, he was likely to get drafted, but he volunteered. And he wanted two things in life. He said, I want to be an old man with a bunch of kids around, and I want to be a combat veteran. Mm. And he's achieved both of those now. But he volunteered and he took tests and when he first volunteered, and he didn't go to college or anything, and they sent him to officer candidate school, and they said your scores are really good, and he's just some hick from the holler, and they said and they wanted to point him to West Point, and he turned down going to West Point because he was afraid he'd miss the war, and he wanted to get married, and he couldn't get married, so he got married and went to Vietnam, and my brother was born while he was in Vietnam, my oldest brother, and he didn't want to be an officer, he kind of wanted to like, but he said when he was going through that process about whether or not he should become an officer or not, and like basically become a, you know, first lieutenant. There were a lot of first lieutenants in Vietnam because a lot of them were being killed, and so there was a lot of need for him. Mm-hmm. But he basically said, I didn't want to be an officer, but I wanted even less to follow orders from somebody else who, you know, if our lives were going to be in somebody's hands, which I didn't like any of it, I wanted them to be in my hands because I didn't feel supremely confident, but I felt like, you know, the God's given me gifts, and the stakes are slightly lower when you're writing a novel, but I feel similarly to that. Like you're describing, like I am by nature, a very anxious person, worried. Like that's my, I think that's the other side of that really thoughtfulness and being somewhat insightful or inventive or whatever, like that I can't turn it off. And so I struggle with anxiety and probably depression and all that kind of stuff. Like that's like my natural state, is to be sort of like things to feel heavy and to have a difficulty sort of breaking free from that, and actually find it really liberating to be caught up in writing a story where I'm not focusing on myself, which is similar to playing sports or something like that, where you just kind of forget yourself for a while. That's like the best feeling in the world. It's like, oh, I'm not thinking about myself anymore.
Yeah.
And I try to orient all my art, all whatever I'm creating. I think of it as a vocation with an apron on, where I'm serving other people. I don't think of myself as like an elite artist who's like, oh, I'm so good, and so now people need to gather around me. I think of myself like a line cook, like, and I don't want to lose the magic of it. I try to sort of hold both. It's this miraculous, beautiful, powerful vocation that's like got stardust in it, and magic and glory and miracle. And I'll never let go of that. But at the same other time, I'm like, it's an ordinary vocation rooted in love and service. And I'm not superior to the plumber or the garbage man or the pastor or the homemaker. I'm like, we're all the same. Mm-hmm. We're all like loving each other and listening to the voice of God to call us to do something in the world. So I try to hold on to both those things at the same time. And even though they conflict, and I'm sure you guys do the same with your music. But so I feel the responsibility, and I really do feel it keenly because of how much I love the kids. And because the book started as stories for my own kids, the some of that problem, some of the crippling anxiety of my life, it has been, well, I say it's been two things. It's been a place in which God has shown up to be for me, to be strength in my weakness, to where that's insane to me that I would ever speak to a group. If you go back 10, 15 years and tell me that I was going to speak to a group of five people, I would have been like, yeah, okay, I'll be president too or something. Like it was the same thing, or I'll play in the NBA. It was like, and at that time I was aware of my limitations. So it's just impossible, impossible to think of. And so it's the same with writing and stuff. So I would have thought I would be completely crippled by that problem. And when I wrote the second book in the Green Ember series, after the first book, really surprisingly, like my first book that I'm like, well, I'll try this out. And then, you know, it'll obviously stink, but someday I'll write something good. And then everyone looked at that book And I was like, oh gosh, that's so terrifying. But that sort of took off. Now I'm writing the second book, and I was like, hey, you know what I'll do? I'll kill a really important character in this book. And for some reason, there was like, I felt a little bit of that, like, tension or worry or what, but I don't know, man, that was like God showing up to me in this really small way. It's not Vietnam. It's not, you know, the stakes are lower, but they're pretty high for me and the audience in a way, because they do care. To them, they're dumb. They think it's like Narnia or something. I'm just kidding. But they do have this, like, it's a big deal to them, which makes it a big deal to me. So I write with this, I think about these three words to sort of anchor me as a career. I think about it as an MFA. I don't have an MFA. I have some suspicion about some MFAs. But I think of it as these three words: modesty, fidelity, and audacity. That I want to be rooted in, like, who I am. My dad, you know, there's a very strong, like, don't get too big for your britches kind of a mentality with people where I come from. So I want to have that modesty. I want to understand that whatever gifts I have, they're from God. And I want to have fidelity. I want to be faithful. I want to be honest. I want to tell true. I want to tell the truth. I want to be like Tolkien, who believed the Lord of the Rings was a true story, not that the events happened, but that it was faithful to reality. Mm-hmm. I want to tell true stories. So I want to have faithfulness, and then I want to have audacity, like, because I can, like, it's okay. Like, out of that abundance, out of that gift, I can be audacious. So I, for some reason, this anxious, fearful, terrified person who would be afraid to speak up, you know, half of my life, I'll talk to a group of 3,000 people, and I'll write something that I think is going to be a gift with a kind of insane confidence that doesn't make any sense. And I don't know where it comes from, but somewhere in that convoluted story is an answer to your question, Dave.
Hang on a second.
Yeah.
I need a break.
Oh, wow.
I know. We worked so hard. Can we grab some coffee?
Gosh. John.
Yeah.
Did you say coffee, right?
Yes.
Okay. Today's episode and what I'm drinking right now, you can hear it. Actually, that's a terrible sound effect I just made. But that cup of Joe that I'm drinking, John, guess what it's brought to you by? Can we sing it together?
Ready? One. 5, 6, 7, 8. Methodical coffee.
Oh, we did it. We both did it fast.
Well, you've got coffee now. You just took a sip.
That's so right. I'm amped. I'm
juiced. Now listen, Methodical Coffee, they have craft coffee and tea for people of all kinds. Roasted, blended, brewed, served, and perfected by verified coffee and tea nerds like you and me, Dave.
Well, more you than me. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Which I don't say that a lot. So if you really want to have a moment,
just say it one more time.
That's exactly right, John.
Yeah, I wanted to say it with you.
And Methodical isn't just the name of their business.
No. Nope.
It's their approach to, well,
everything.
Everything.
Yeah. But Dave, you know what? Best of Methodical's coffee? It's got to be our Dadville blend.
Yes, John. The Dadville blend is the fuel that gets me going. It's not the only fuel that gets me going, everyone. I mean, my family, God.
The gospel. Yeah,
God. Sure. But it's a big part. It's the liquid fuel.
Okay. Yeah, there we go.
Filled with hints of chocolate, graham, and brown sugar.
Well, Dave, Methodical, they're on a mission to connect people to the beauty of life through coffee experiences for people like you, right? Methodical's been roasting and hosting for over 9 years. That's almost 10 years. They offer a wide selection of coffees and teas that are complex yet easygoing.
Oh, Johnny, I'm just giggles McGillicuddy over here. On their site, you'll also find who is a big Methodical fan.
Yeah, he is.
He
does web design for them now.
On their site, you'll find brew guides, John, that'll teach you how to turn your coffee brewing chore into a beloved ritual. Craft a cup you'll love with Methodical Coffee. Also, get 10% off your first order of coffee or tea with discount code. Say it with me.
Dadville.
Man.
Dave, I want to give a shout out. And when I give a shout out, I always laugh because it just brings me so much joy to give a shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with free samples.
You know it, John. This time of year, my allergies are in fuego. They're always on the attack, but I use this and you should too.
Oh, I do, Dave. every day in our house. Yeah. Luckily, for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D.
Designed for serious allergy sufferers, which is, me raising my hand, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill to relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better.
This double-action combination of prescription-strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, and itchy nose and throat and sinus congestion and pressure with ease.
John, I've been taking Claritin D for my allergies for a long time, and it's been an absolute life changer. I can go for a run without my eyes watering. I may be crying, but it's not
sure,
from allergies.
Totally different.
And I can sing without feeling like I have a big old, let's not even call it a frog. It's like a toad.
It's like a family of toads.
It's a family. It's a turtle.
Yeah.
In my throat.
So, you ready to live life as if you don't have allergies?
Yeah, me.
It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter.
Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed.
That's great. I think it leads to another question. I'm curious. I love the way that you answer that, by the way, because I think it's a reminder to me that, you know, you obviously care, but I mean, in your explanation, it's so much of what you're inferring is that, you know, like you really care about this too. It's not just, you know, it's not just words on a page that you're going, where does it go next? It's like, God, I want to feel, you know, same as writing songs. Like me and John have to feel it first for them to feel it. And it's funny. I'm like, well, of course that's how it works. But I mean, it's still, I just, the weight of it feels enormous to me, especially when it's working, because all of a sudden that's that many eyes on you going like, well, it left on a cliffhanger. What happens book three? And you're kind of like, goo.
Well, and you get anxiety about, like, I will get anxiety while I'm writing a song. I'll often come to like forks in the road where I'm like, I want to take it this way, but I know if I go this way, that's a little more marketable or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's are you constantly coming to that fork in the road, or is it slightly different for you?
It's a little different, I think, because I didn't, when we started, like, these are stories I told my kids. And so it was an experience of many, many years of me telling them, it started on a porch, like 50 yards from where I am right now. I'm in a little garden shed writing office, which I call the forge, which is, you know, where a smith works in the forge. So it's this little humble garden shed. My commute is, you know, 10 seconds from the house, but the porch, that's where the story started. And it started because my daughter was there and she's a little girl and I used to tell her stories. And then we're on the porch and people often ask about the rabbits, because my stories are about rabbits. And I did, you know, why did you choose rabbits? And I always tell them that I'm a rabbit Calvinist, because I didn't choose the rabbits. The rabbits chose me. But because they were there and they were like there in the yard. And I just started telling her a story about rabbits, you know, like here you are. And so and she loved it. So I just told her more. And then like for years and years, I told her and her brother story. So it was all love. It was all honest and it was all organic. So when we got to the climax of the Green Ember happened in this first iteration out loud with my kids, I didn't know. It was all improvisation at the time. And we finished this moment in the story and they were like quiet. And in my mind, I was like, that was awesome. Like, great job, Dad. And then they were, Dad, that's amazing. Like, we got, you know, you got to write this down. This is so good. And so I was like, okay. And then, so I wrote it down just thinking like, this will be a gift to my kids. Like if nothing else happens, it'll be a memorial. So the stakes were so low in a sense, they were really high for us, but it was a special, it was only our thing. So it was radically organic, so I had a radical indifference to the market from the very beginning of my career. I never, so I didn't think about it at all. I think I found out later, oh, the market's not interested in personified animals. That's like passé or whatever. And I was like, I don't care. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't look anything up. Yeah. We just wrote the book for my kids. And I was like, I'll write the best book for them. And if it doesn't go anywhere else, we won already, because they'll have it in their house and they'll read it to their kids and it'll be this sort of like memorial of our time together and a relic and a crazy old Uncle Sam or crazy old grandpa wrote this book. So when we shared it with the world, which was partly responsible, my brother-in-law and partner, he was like, I like this a lot. I think people share it. So then it just, we got a little tryout with an audience because of, I think, some goodwill. You know, nobody had ever read anything I'd written fiction wise, but some people gave it a try and it had a good cover, I think. And then it was just like, it just, people started sharing it with other people. So it was totally organic. So like, and what we found out is, oh, there were other people like us that like this kind of story. So it was, so I didn't have time at the beginning. So that was a massive gift. I wasn't thinking about the market at all. And of course, over time, I did my job at some point along the way. And cause it was, you know, it was kind of inevitable. We needed to do something. So we try to figure out how to market, but even in those early months, people would say like, what's your marketing strategy? I want to do what you did. And I'm like, I'm working two jobs. I'm volunteering at my church. I'm coaching soccer. My kids are little. I don't know what you're talking about. Like my marketing strategy is a bunch of moms gave it to other moms. So because they loved it. And it wasn't because it's like, the Grapes of Wrath or something. It wasn't brilliantly written or anything. Something about it resonated deeply with the audience and they started sharing it. So I would say I've like entered into the freedom of that natural, because it's so rooted in love. Every time I write, I'm just thinking about my kids. And now I've met like tens of thousands of other kids on the road. I've looked in their faces and they're wearing rabbit ears and they're like telling. So I like have this confidence that I know I know them and they know me and I love them. And it's just like sitting down at home and telling my kid a story. So I haven't thought too much while I'm creating. I felt a freedom to like really do that thing that I think all artists want is like to really try to just like tell an honest story. So I haven't felt. I don't know. I do have the other hat on, the entrepreneur hat that I've got to put on, but I don't feel like I do that when I'm writing. I feel like I do that at other times, if that makes sense. So what I'm saying is I'm a better person than you. I think.
So, that's what I took away from
all
it.
I'm hearing.
Think,
and I think your kids probably don't respect
my dad
you.
Judging me somehow out of nowhere. Yeah, yeah. And your dad, who is a vet, I mean, he's judging me. I haven't even met him.
For sure.
The thing, so one of the things, I mean, you nail this point. I mean, again, you know, your audience is so much of kids. Like, this is something I've thought a lot about. Let me give you a little back story to where I'm going with this. But I was with a friend of mine this weekend. I had a show last weekend. And we were kind of talking about, like, how we've been spending the holidays and you know, somehow it came up like what we were watching. And I was like, you know, I thought about doing Harry Potter with the kids. I have a 12-year-old, 9-year-old, and a 7-year-old. And I was like, you know, I thought about doing Harry Potter, but I was like, man, I don't know. Like, it just, you know, it just feels maybe like a little intense. And he said something I thought was really interesting. He's like, I don't know, man. I think you're selling your kids short. I was like, you think so? And he was like, yeah, I mean, and here's a huge asterisk, but it has to be said, our kids were in a school shooting, you know, 7 months ago. So that's a whole, obviously that matters. So you always have to think about that. But that being over there, I was like, what do you mean? He's like, I don't know, man. And he talked about this book called The Coddling of America, which I haven't read yet, but I want to read. The thing it made me think about is that would be interesting if I'm you, because you're writing for kids. You're trying, how do you, so the couple questions in this space I had is like, when you're writing a bad guy, the you know, the nemesis, whatever. How do you think about how to present that in a way that, you know, because how evil can it be? How dark can it be? And then I think sort of part two of that question, how do you think as an author that's writing this stuff, how should we think about kids and stories and sort of scary things? Like, how do you navigate that in a way that it's presenting the theme you want it to, but it's not being so egregious that kids are like, I can't read this anymore. This is like terrifying. You know what I mean? How do you do that?
Well, I've never had that kind of question framed with the weight of your experience, which is such a good sobering.
Well, I don't mean to. I'd say that just because.
No, it's good. I love it because
I'm not trying to. But I.
No,
something I think about is what I'm saying.
I'm grateful
it can't be
for
as easy
that.
As like I'm, let's just watch it potentially.
I'm super grateful for that context, because that is such a gift, because it takes away from the sort of like the theory of like, oh yeah, there's tough stuff in life, but you know, chin up and or whatever. It's not, you can't be flippant when you experience
right,
something like
right,
that.
For
you have
sure.
To be, yeah. You have to be honest. Yeah. And so I come from the sort of like, you know, I don't like putting down like Christian art or movies or stuff. I think that's like, it's the easiest thing in the world is to go on Facebook and say like, oh, that Christian movie was stupid. You know, what's really hard is making a movie is very hard.
Right.
So I have a lot of respect for people who just try things. It's just, it's hard to do anything. It's hard to stick your neck out in a world.
Right.
So I respect people that try things. I will say that I don't love the approach of there's a lot of bad things in the culture and a lot of toxic stuff. And so we're really frustrated with that. And I sympathize with all that. And then, so what, therefore I will do is I will do a clean, I don't like dirty. So I will do clean. I don't like this, all this, violence and horrible sort of stuff, satanic or terrible. So I'm going to write, safe things. And I don't like safe, because kids will experience death and because they will experience, they will definitely experience a death scene, their own and many others probably in life. And I have, a result of these books being sort of taking kids very seriously and not patting them on the head and saying, you're right. If you just do the right thing, everything will work out and you'll win the championship or whatever. Like, I hate that kind of thing because we call that safe, but I think that's far more dangerous. So I write dangerous books and I want to write dangerous books for kids who are dangerous. And I want them to be dangerous to the darkness. I want them to be so full of light, so full of courage, moral courage. But that, to me, to achieve that end, you have to go through, you know, Winston Churchill said, if you're going through hell, keep going. And I just think, like, you can't write good stories if you coddle the characters. You have to kill them. You have to go after them. You have to chase them up a tree, as the cliche goes, and throw stones at them. Like, that's if you love them. You do. And that's the experience of human beings. We don't become characters that are brave or heroic or share or sacrifice unless we go through pain. And the Green Ember itself, that book, I mean, if I could tell you the story, I cannot believe that book ever came out. It was the biggest example of the giving birth of something through the worst labor pains. And we probably all have stories like that. Something that's beautiful and surprising and resonating that comes out of like deep, deep, deep pain. And so that was the experience of giving it. But I take your point about, like, I don't think it's cool. Like, there's another emphasis to sort of in cult culture to, like, sort of like, I want to be edgy, or I want to, like, try to, like, where's the edge? I think it's neat to, for some reason, I think a lot of kids growing up in Christian culture are like, I want to find the edge, and I think it's cool to, like, I don't care about that. That doesn't interest me at all. Like, vice, I think Simone Weil talks about, like, imaginary evil is, like, interesting and exciting, but, like, real evil is boring and dumb. And then sometimes imaginary good is, I'm murdering this quote, but imaginary good is sort of presented as dull, but real good is beautiful and life-giving and that kind of thing. So I don't like shows that are just dark for dark's sake, or like heavy, or just trying to be edgy or push the envelope. I don't care about that. I care about loving the kids and telling them an authentic story that feels real, that where the characters go through really intense stuff. But it's not like we're not indulging it. You know, I describe it as like, it's a difference between like a person going for a swim in a septic tank is different than a person losing their wedding ring and they dive in to try to like find it, and they find it and they get out. That's different than just like, I'm just hanging out in here because it's cool. Or I don't mind the brush with the septic tank, but it has to have meaning and it has to have purpose. So I like strong moral stories that where the kids are challenged and they face death and there's tough stuff in a way that's generous. And I always just use it as my own kids. I think about them, I tend to agree with the person who says like kids are more equipped for more than you think. And that's one reason. It's a nice thing about my books being the Green Ember books being about rabbits is there's a little bit of a displacement, a little bit of like you can do a little bit more. A kid can a little bit deeper and not be like, oh my goodness, this is like right next door. They can enter into a vicarious experience of some violence and of some death and of some sort of suffering. And I can't tell you the result of that has been, and again, through no design of my own, a generous byproduct from God is that I've heard from innumerable folks going through childhood cancer, tragedies, difficult things, who sit around in cancer wards reading these books aloud and feeling brave. Mm. And I can't tell you how many kids sent pictures of kids who are donating bone marrow to their sibling. This has happened multiple times, wearing their Green Ember shirt that says, "My place beside you, my blood for yours, till the Green Ember rises or the end of the world."
Wow.
And they resonate with this stuff in a way that, like, I didn't design it, but it's like this byproduct of taking them very seriously and loving them and saying, like, "I respect you intellectually," which the best authors do. Madeline Engel, you know, 90 publishers told her, "Kids don't talk like this." And of course, what happens when the book gets published? Boom. Everybody's like, "Oh my goodness, it's awesome." C.S. Lewis takes kids seriously. I think J.K. Rowling takes kids seriously. So I want to do that. I want the stakes to be high. I want it to feel important. And I want them to go through these vicarious experiences of death. And because I think dangerous stories are important, especially when they're written with an honesty about, like, the capital R reality sort of flowing through them, a submission to sort of the way God made the world and receiving it as a gift, but also this dangerous landscape. Mm. I think that can be, I mean, I know that's powerful for me and my kids, so I just want to give that gift.
Man, that is beautiful.
Yeah.
I love the way you put that. Taking kids seriously, it's so funny because as you say that and you talk about those authors, that is the sort of through line, you know, is there's no pandering, there's no, like, you know, breaking things down to the most digestible bits. That's a wonderful way to put that.
I'm sorry, when you see that, when you see it in a movie or something, like, "You guys are all right. I'm patting you on the head. Everything you guys think is right. And somebody deviated from that, but they got back on track and now they're okay." Like, you know, it's not true. You don't believe it. It can have like 1,000 true facts in it and be completely dishonest, like, at its core. Mm-hmm. Like, and I don't want to lie to kids because they are going to have shootings and cancer, and we're all gonna, you know the suffering that comes. If you just get married and have a job, you are gonna have suffering. You know, and so you got to be prepared. Like, that's part of the whole, like, gift of, like, sort of empathy and vicarious experience of fiction, is that you get to exercise your imagination in these ways. And so if I can equip kids, if I can give them some kind of a gift, even if it's a small, moves the needle a little bit for them. I mean, what would you rather do in the world than love a bunch of vulnerable kids? And you get invited into their home and their heart. Mm-hmm. It's like the best honor anybody could ask for. It's such a privilege and such an honor.
I can't imagine how you must feel seeing those pictures, like in the cancer ward and the little kids going to donate blood with the shirt on. I mean, that's so powerful. That's amazing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and they are truly heroic people, and I love it because, I mean, they have a language for understanding it, because they see these sort of heroic characters and they think, well, I'll do what they did. I'll lay down my life. I'll do this. And it's incredible. They're so inspiring to me.
That is crazy. One of the things that I think is so cool about what you do too, which was really fun to see so much in your Instagram, is that your kids are so involved in sort of your space. This, you know, be it that you wrote this book with your son, which is so cool and crazy. And then I love the picture of your daughter that's selling her earrings. I love that they're on stage with you playing. What is sort of the methodology there? I mean, I know, you know, low hanging fruit is, like, it's just fun to have your kids around, but is there an intentionality to that too? Like, you've sort of workshopped or seen, or is that something they came to you and said, "Hey, we want to be a part of this too"? Like, how do you think about that?
I think it's mostly an economic decision. Like, you start to really understand the roots of slavery and you just say, like, I can get these people and I don't have to pay them a whole lot.
The tax write-off.
Yeah. It's really easy. No. It's so organic. Again, it's just like, this is the need and then here we are. And, like, having them, I think I've always just, that's a MO for us. Naturally, we homeschool and we do that sort of, like, it's just, I don't know. We always, I always wanted to be a dad. I was always that kind of a guy. Like, always, like, a looking out for this little kid and, like, putting a blanket over somebody and helping someone through the barbed wire fence. And, like, that's my natural. So I love the togetherness. I love it. And I love having the whole family together. So, and I always long for, shepherding and sort of pastoring and, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I've been in my life. I've sometimes been like, "Oh, that's the smartest guy here. So let's, like, listen to him and he's going to tell us something," or, you know, like, I get put in those positions sometimes in small community sort of stuff, and always long for somebody to just say, like, hey, Sam, you know how like you don't want anybody to tell you to go to bed, and then like you get old enough and you're like, I wish somebody would tell me to go to bed. I wish somebody would give me limits, some mentorship. I've always longed for that. And my parents were great. They were wonderful in so many ways. My dad was definitely of his generation, which was like, they'll figure it out kind of a thing, which is cool. And there's all kinds of gifts in that too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I was definitely a person who longed to like, this is the way. Oh, you want to do this? Like, and I hope it was generous. I hope it's not heavy handed, but so I love bringing the kids in. I love it. I love that they feel comfortable. I love that my really, really shy kids, which was what I was, have been invited to at a convention or something to man a table and to look people in the eye and to be able to say to them, I know you're scared, but don't even just look at them. Like they need you, they need help. So just love them. That's all you got to do. See them. And like, and having that, my own experience of like my own anxiety drain away as I actually turn my eyes to other people instead of thinking internally all the time, and to invite my sort of anxious kids into that opportunity to grow. And I love it. I love it. I love the discipleship. I love the sort of like hands-on on entrepreneurship, on faith, on life, culture sort of stuff. I eat that up. That is such a, and I love, mm-hmm. the whole vocation, like that I don't have to pretend. I really appreciate, you know, I've had different jobs in life where you're kind of like, you got to not lie, but you just have to like, sort of, it's not like the main thing on your heart and you got to sort of represent it or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's not, never mm-hmm. thing, like nothing that would like violate a conscience, but I'm just saying, I love waking up. Like I don't have to pretend like right. I really love the families or the kids that I love working with my kids and I love bringing them along. Like it's just, it's cool. It's, and I'm sure you guys have the similar experience, but that is like the relief involved in just that. There's not another layer that it can be really authentic is it's like the end of the movie stuff. Like I'm not a millionaire. I'm not super rich. Like we're okay. Like we're feeding our kids. We live in West Virginia. We don't have a high cost of living. We're okay. But I already feel like it's the end of the movie, you know, like it's okay. Like we're together and it's a gift, you know, it's fine. I don't need to like make a big movie deal or, you know, be a real big time bestseller or get a big award. It's okay. That's like that family stuff is, I wouldn't trade that for $1 jillion.
Yeah. Oh, it's a big payoff.
Yeah.
So what are the challenges? It's interesting the age of your kids, because a lot of the dads we have on tend to have kids around our, you know, our kids' ages. What are the challenges you find? Or how, the better way to ask that, sorry, is like, what are the ways parenting your kids, they get older? Like, how is that different? Like, what are you seeing now that you're having to sort of exhibit as a dad that maybe wasn't as present?
And does it look like the way you always thought it would look?
And I don't know. I heard all the warnings and like all the, you know, like people will tell you, oh, you know, it doesn't, they grow up quick and it goes by fast and all the cliches, which are, you know, I find myself telling other people and, too, and just completing the cycle. I love it. I really do. It's different. I'm a sort of a tenderhearted guy. I love the little squishy, like the fat legs and the little squishy kisses and snuggles and stuff. I'm not sure that'll win me like man of the year.
Well, my wife loves me
stuff, but I love that sort of stuff. So I miss that, that stage, but I do love this sort of, moving into sort of a collegial sort of a peer kind of a thing, because I really have tried to sort of our approach, you know, for better or for worse, was that we were going to do like big love, big discipline, sort of like that we were going to not be absent on the sort of like, here's the border. We were going to, I believe that, you know, like Chesterton talks about sort of like walking along a cliffside in the fog is different than walking on a clear day. And sort of like clarity of like, I long for that kind of clarity of like, what should I be doing here? You know? And so there's clarity, there's discipline, there's, you know, loving sort of correction, but there's big love. There's always going to be hugs and you're never going to have a doubt about like where you fit in. So that's sort of been and I'm always trying to parent, even from an early age, with the idea that like, yeah, I'm your father and this is your mother and we're like authority. And that's true. There's like, you got to kind of listen to us during this period, but what we're preparing you for, like, that's not we're not trying to prepare you for a life of dependence on us in the same way. So having that in mind the whole time to some degree and sort of functionally having to sort of, you know, you got to like, you know, you got to eat that, sorry. And no, you can't hit that person or you can't, you know, you got to like have these sort of like moments, but it's never been about punishment to me. It's never been about like, I am the moral authority of the universe and you have stepped outside of the boundaries and now I must hurt you in order to like restore cosmic balance. It's always about mm-hmm. like, there's a train yeah. here, there's a road. And like, oh, you're going off the road here toward the poison berries or whatever. Like, here, come on, let's go back over on the road. Like, here's the road, because I'm walking on the road. You're walking on the road. Pretty soon, you'll just be walking on the road, like, in your own strength. I won't have to carry you. And you'll be helping other people. Like, don't go over there. That's really dumb. That you can get killed over there. That's really stupid. That hurts people if you go down down the abandoned mine shaft or whatever. Just kind of stick on the road here. So there's been like a little bit of a loving sort of correction. Like, we walk in this way. And to sort of have that in mind and then now to see it is really nice. And to move into that little bit more yeah. of a colleague, I like that. Mm. I like that I learned from my son and my daughter, like that they're doing things in the world and I'm listening to them. And there's still like a lot of respect and a lot of love and a lot of affection. But I like the changing thing. I'm trying to discipline myself to be less of a lecturer and more of a listener, more of a soft-hearted person who's you know, trying to support them and trying to let them go, like have that right balance of like, you know, you've got protection here, you've got a welcome here, but you've also got this independence. I like it. It's a new challenge. It's fun. You know, the horror stories all come from like, oh, it's going to be so bad because they'll make all these bad decisions and you'll be bailing them out with money all the time. I've heard all those and I'm not trying to be arrogant, like, oh, that'll never happen. I know there'll be trouble ahead. Like there are for all of us. There is for all of us, but I love it. I love this stage. It's there's pain associated with it, but there was pain associated with the other ones too. I haven't wiped a poopy bottom in a long time. And I have different pains, but I like it. I like it. It's growing up. I will be the one that's losing it when the last one or when the first one honestly is gone for you're really gone. That is me. But even that, like what a privilege that that you're not like throwing a party, like they're out of here. I'm so glad. Like to the pain, just like if we lost someone in a death, which we might at any moment, you know, I'm glad that we had the love. I'm glad that the love is there. I'm glad that when that pain comes, I'll hope that I'll remember to be grateful for it because it's been a gift all along the way. And it's still a gift. And I hope to God, genuinely to God that I can, that I would be like a faithful, I want to be a good dad when my daughter's 57, you know, if I'm still alive, just like I hopefully was when she was seven.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Well, that's beautiful. It's okay. Like that's like a perfect summation. Okay. So first of all, thank you so much for hanging with us. We end these with what we call the lightning round, which is native to us. We're the first people to kind of do something like this. And so it's really quick questions. You know, just top of mind. I'll ask first one. Here we go. Buckle up. If you could have dinner with three writers, dead or alive,
who are they? They'd be alive while you're eating, though.
Well, I don't know. I'm okay if they're not.
Yeah. Yeah, you could say they could all be dead.
Be a quiet conversation.
Wow. Tolkien. Shakespeare and Saint John, the beloved apostle.
Look at that. Oh,
what a table that would be.
I'm trading right. Shakespeare out I'm immediately regretting it. I'm trading Shakespeare out for the writer of Ecclesiastes. Okay, sorry. Final answer. Locked in.
Oh, there we go. That's
final answer. Okay, there we go. Favorite book of all time?
The Lord of the Rings.
That's
have you heard of it? I'm trying to tell people about it.
I'm just writing it down right now. Rings.
A lot of people are like Green Ember. I'm like, guys, I know, but have you just checked out this Tolkien guy? I think he should give him a chance.
So it's not Therings. That's helpful.
Okay, Lord of Therings.
Is Lord of Therings.
Yeah.
So, okay, next question. Does your wife read your books? And let me say this. If not, I get it. I feel that deeply. If she does, congrats. I just know that books are so much more of a commitment than music. So is that something where she really sits down and reads them, or how does that work?
I think she reads them. It's funny. She's not, this probably sounds terrible, but she's not like, it's almost cool that she's not like in that world. And like going crazy, you know, she's not like a super fan. She's a super fan of me, but she's like, it's kind of my, it's my job, and she likes it and she's approves of it. And she sort of like looks for mistakes. She's good at that.
Yeah.
In lots of areas. No, I'm just kidding. She's great. She reads the books and she's really good. She does have a good kind of eye for catching errors, which I make a lot of. And so she likes them. Yeah.
All right. So if the whole world could stop and read one of your books, which one would you want them to read?
The Green Ember. I started to say Mooses and Bazookas and other stories that children should never read, but that would be a very stupid answer, and I think I've given enough of those already.
You've had your quotient.
We always have time for one more.
We do. It's Dadville after all. Okay, I'm gonna round up this whole thing. So buckle up. If you wrote a book, this is a great question to actually ask an author. If you wrote a book on being a dad, what would the title of that book be?
It might be Big Love, Big Discipline. I don't like it. It's not very poetic, but.
Oh, yeah.
No. I've got it. It would be this. This is my second correction and I hope final correction of the evening. This is something my dad always told me everywhere I went. When he would drop me off at school, drop me off at a party, at a game, anywhere, when I would walk out the door, he would say, "Don't forget whose boy you are." And I always say that to my kids. Don't forget whose boy you are. Don't forget whose girl you are. And that would be the title. Don't forget whose boy you are.
I love that. Oh, that's so good. You got to write that book, man. That's beautiful. So anything before we release you back to the wild, to the hollers of West Virginia, anything that you want to plug? What's the newest thing? What should everybody be paying attention to in your world?
I don't know. I mean, the newest book is The Mooses with Bazookas, which is funny because you guys are such goofballs. I assumed that we'd be talking about that the whole time. Instead, there's all this. We're talking about cancer and shootings and everything's deep and heavy and which I love. I love that stuff too. My newest book is just a very silly book, which actually is helpful too when you're going through a tough time. It's that's part of the design is sometimes it's good just to laugh.
That's
what that book's about. It's a very silly book.
Well, just know if you need some soundtracks, me and John are ready.
We are at the ready.
Strings and fingers poised over keys.
I was really hoping for more of your guys' impromptu little a cappella sort of stuff. That's probably among the many disappointments with this conversation. That's one of them.
We do all that off air.
Oh, can you do insert them? You insert them in.
Oh my gosh!
You'll fix it in post.
Yeah, we do that in post. It's later. That's all Jason. Yeah,
it's all post. That's Jason, your favorite guy. Dude, Sam, thank you so much.
Yeah, this was great.
Thanks so much. We so appreciate what you do.
Oh, it's such an honor to talk to you guys. I know I joked around a little bit and poked fun at you. I assume that's kind of my love language, growing up with a bunch of brothers and stuff. So I hope that you don't get off this call and cry intensely for hours. This was a privilege. Thank you, guys.
Well, we do. That's a normal end of Dadville.
But that has nothing to do with you.
Yeah. That's all that shit.
That's all me and my dad. That's just me.
That's the reason for the podcast. Thanks again, Sam. We really appreciate it, man.
Thanks, man. Thank you. Dadville.